This week, the U.S. hits Russian state media with new sanctions.
They are engaged in covert influence activities aimed at undermining American elections and democracies, functioning like a de facto arm of Russia's intelligence apparatus.
Could young voters be the deciding factor on the next president?
There is no path to victory for the presidential candidate without the youth vote.
And what's at stake in the election when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
I'm most concerned about questions of war and peace and whether a war happened that might otherwise be preventable.
Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Everyone, I'm Lori London in Washington. The U.S. State Department announced new sanctions on Russian state media on Friday, while the outlet RT has previously been sanctioned for its work to spread Kremlin propaganda and disinformation. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said RT is a key part of Russia's war machine and its efforts to undermine its democratic adversaries.
These Kremlin-backed media outlets are not only playing this covert influence role to undermine democracy in the United States, but also to meddle in the sovereign affairs of countries around the world.
Blinken accused the Kremlin news outlet of working together with the Russian military and running fundraising campaigns to pay for weapons and equipment for soldiers fighting in Ukraine.
While the crowdfunding campaign is out in the open, what's hidden is that this program is administered by the leaders of RT.
Blinken just wrapped up a trip to Europe that included a visit to Kyiv with his UK counterpart. And before departing, he said Ukraine's push to ease restrictions on the use of weapons from the U.S. and Britain were on the agenda in White House talks between President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Keir Starmer Friday afternoon.
As we go forward, we will do exactly what we have already done, which is we will adjust, we'll adapt as necessary, including with regard to the means that are at Ukraine's disposal to effectively defend against the Russian aggression.
My colleague Steve Karish spoke with Jenny Mathers, professor of international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales, for insights into possible indications that the U.S. could be softening its stance on the issue.
President Zelensky has been asking the Western allies to allow Ukraine to use Western weapons, longer range Western weapons, to fire inside Russia at targets inside Russia to prevent them from launching attacks on Ukraine. And it's being widely reported, though not confirmed yet, that that will happen.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And this is, I think, you know, it's an issue which Keir Starmer has demonstrated he feels very passionately about. You know, just on the plane over to Washington, he was asked about Putin's latest comments, threatening unnamed things might happen if the Ukrainians are allowed to use Western supplied weapons to strike deep in Russia. And you know, he basically said, well, you know, this is Putin's own fault. He's responsible for this war, and if he wants to end it, then he can. So I think, you know, this is a big issue for Keir Starmer. It's one that he's willing to really try and lead on as much as possible, but really to try and encourage the Americans to move on their position. You know, they've been so very careful and conservative and cautious in creating all these sort of boundaries and restrictions about what the Ukrainians can and cannot do with weapons that the Americans have produced. And so this is a moment really to try and I think demonstrate as well that Britain still kind of punches above its weight in the international community. It has the ear of the Americans, and it can help persuade them to change their tune.
Earlier, you brought up what Starmer had said on the plane about Russia's reaction to Britain and the U.S. allowing Ukraine to use weapons to target inside Russia. Russia has now expelled a number of British diplomats from Russia.
Yeah, it's interesting that today is the day that the FSB, the major sort of intelligence agency in Russia, has decided to announce that fact, because actually it happened last month. It's one of these things which reflects, I think, the deteriorating relationship between Britain and Russia, and between Russia and the West more generally. But the decision on which day, at what time to make this as a big statement, I think it really demonstrates that Russia is using these kinds of tools very instrumentally. You know, these are things which are being used to try and not only demonstrate, you know, Russia's unhappiness with Western policies and with British policies in particular, but also as a way of amplifying its position, a way of being heard in the world, drawing attention to itself. It's not enough to do the thing. You have to really be seen to be doing it, and you have to make a loud noise about it, and people have to notice it. So I think the timing of the announcement is really interesting.
What else do you think we could expect from Moscow?
Well, I think probably more sort of operations in the shadows, if you like. I think a lot of attention gets paid to Putin's pronouncements and the worry that we're going to see an escalation in the war, which will involve, you know, attacks on NATO or nuclear weapons or something of that order, something really spectacular. And I think it's much more likely that we're going to see more of these lower level kinds of responses. So expelling diplomats, you know, looking for more Westerners to arrest in Russia, to use as future sort of hostages in prisoner exchanges, maybe more covert operations happening abroad, you know, sabotage actions in Europe, that kind of thing. I think these are the kinds of things that Putin is very comfortable with. They create problems for Ukraine's international supporters without taking the you know, sort of the escalation up to astronomical levels.
Jenny Mathers is a professor of international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Professor Mathers, thanks for your analysis today. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
Americans got a closer look this week at presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in a debate Tuesday night. Both were back on the campaign trail this week, and it seemed unclear if there would be another debate before the November 5th presidential election.
I believe we owe it to the voters to have another debate.
Are we going to do a rematch? I just don't know. We'll think about it.
Whoever becomes the next president of the United States will have a host of issues to contend with when it comes to foreign policy and national security. Would a Harris presidency be a continuation of the Biden administration? And what would a second Trump term mean for U.S. relations with allies and adversaries? Joining us now to talk more about it is Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution.
There are so many pressing issues around the world, major conflicts. We've got Ukraine and Gaza. We've got competition with China. What's at stake here regarding whoever becomes the next president?
One way to look at it is to look at the world and the issues, like you just said, and ask which ones are at the most crucial moments. And if you did it that way, you'd certainly have to put Russia and China near the top of any list of traditional threats, and probably even at the top of even a broader list that includes climate change and pandemic and so forth, because, you know, things are so tense right now and the possibility of war is non-trivial, even though that probably seems like a weird thing for most Americans to hear. They probably don't really think in those terms. But those of us who do this stuff, we really do worry that there could be a war against one of those countries. And it's not in the high probability range, but even a lower probability is scary when you're talking about nuclear armed adversaries. So I certainly think that at the issues level, given that the Russian war in Ukraine continues, given that China's acute threat to Taiwan and its rapid rise continue, those two focal points need to be front and center. But the other way to look at it is just to start with this moment in American democracy and think about the kind of leader we're going to elect. And obviously, Trump is the more controversial and disruptive and unusual candidate, even if Harris is less well known. Of course, she's not unknown. She's been vice president for 4 years. You know, she's a more traditional kind of operator. She relies on process, on staff work, on framing of options, deliberate consideration of possibilities. You would presume she places a high premium on diplomacy. She's been part of a Biden, Blinken, Austin team that's been notable for, whether you like them or not, they are pretty sort of traditionalist in how they make decisions and implement them. And so the question really becomes, for me at least, would Trump be sort of like he was in the first term, where on balance his bark was worse than his bite, and he wound up threatening to break off alliances and threatening war with North Korea and things like that, and usually pulled back, largely at the behest of advisors that were from a more traditionalist ilk in American foreign policy? Or would Trump be more disruptive and, since he wound up firing most of the people, has run a campaign that has relied more on loyalists and cronies and suggested that he'd be more disruptive and that he regrets having his own power to disrupt sort of reined in? Would he come out of the blocks with a much more disruptive agenda and really try to fundamentally change the way we've operated by on a bipartisan basis roughly since 1945? That is by far and away for me the biggest question. Which Trump would you get?
And if that were the case, that he did follow through on some of the things he promises, and how could that impact national security and global peace?
I'm most concerned about questions of war and peace and whether a war happened that might otherwise be preventable. And, you know, Trump, I just wrote a piece on this where I'm basically saying, comparing Trump and Harris as prospective future presidents, and ask, to what extent do we know how to interpret Trump? And on the one hand, to be fair and to be empirical, based on what he did as president the first time, he did not start new wars, and he likes to brag about that. And I appreciate hearing him brag about it, not because I give him as much credit as he gives himself, but because I'm glad to know that there's a peacenik side to him, that he actually considers it a virtue not to have started any wars, because it does suggest that at the end he may pull back from the brink, and that his belligerence is actually more in the form of rhetoric and American domestic politics rather than in the form of wielding the spear. That's encouraging. On the other hand, he is so impetuous in certain situations where a certain steadiness is really important that I worry that he could send the wrong message. For example, you know, he talks about how maybe he wouldn't defend Taiwan because they don't necessarily do enough for their own security, and why should the United States have to then go in and bail them out? Well, that's extremely dangerous rhetoric when keeping the peace vis-a-vis China over Taiwan is largely a question of persuading China that we very well might fight if they attack Taiwan, that we very well might come to Taiwan's defense. And so if Trump is all over the place rhetorically, I worry that that could increase the chances of war. And, you know, Trump himself, if he were in this conversation, he'd probably say, no, China knows that I'm not a guy they can mess with. And, you know, I'm pushing Taiwan to a certain extent, but I would find ways to let China know that I'm no softy. And I think the Chinese know that about me, and they know I don't like them, and blah, blah, blah. But it still boils down to, do the Chinese potentially interpret Trump as a person who would not fight in defense of Taiwan? And then with Putin and Russia and Ukraine, I don't know. You know, Trump is friendly to Putin, and he's invited Russia to attack NATO countries that don't meet their 2% of GDP military burden sharing requirement. I don't know that Putin would really do that. But what if Trump clearly goes into this whole Russia-Ukraine situation with a lot of contradictory sentiments? He likes Putin more than he seems to like half our NATO allies, and yet he would inherit a war that is Russia's decision and Russia's fault, where the United States has been crucial in helping Ukraine survive as a country. And is Trump really going to pull the plug on that? I just think it's impossible to read him. And he claims he has a plan for how to end the war in 24 hours through compromise and negotiation. That probably implies freezing the territorial division right where the front line is now, because how else could you have a peace plan come, you know, that you decide on in 24 hours? And I fear that shows that Trump's not realistic, because neither Zelensky nor Putin would accept that kind of a compromise right now. Maybe Trump feels like he could talk them into it by sheer force of personality, and maybe he could, but what if he's wrong, and what's he going to do next? So Trump is just more unpredictable. He's fundamentally unpredictable on some of these questions, and I don't really think he himself has thought them through several steps ahead. He sort of improvises as he goes, and that can be dangerous. I mean, I supported him trying to talk to Kim Jong-un in North Korea. That was fine, but the problem was that he ran out of ideas after a while, because he never had a clear strategy in mind for what he was going to talk to Kim Jong-un about, or what kind of compromises or trade-offs he might accept with the North Koreans. So he just goes into these things trusting his own instincts and thinking one step at a time, and that's not necessarily a great way to make strategy. So I'm going to finish here and say that the hopeful part is that Trump really doesn't like violence, and that his bark is worse than his bite, and that he threatens more than he follows through. But the bad news is that he may have learned or deduced after 4 years in the White House that if he doesn't go in and just start disruptive decision making right away, that the deep state will slow him down and prevent him from making the big changes that he wants. And therefore, he may be much more assertive going in.
And about Kamala Harris, do you see her continuing pretty much in line with President Biden?
I think that she's going to want to be seen as a change agent on issues where we're bogged down right now, most specifically the Gaza crisis and the U.S.-Mexico border crisis and possibly Ukraine. So on those issues, I think, at least for political posturing, she'll want to be seen as a change agent, even though she is Biden's vice president. And, you know, one of the things about Harris that contributed to the fact that if she had run in an open primary, she probably would not have gotten the nomination is that she was not really seen as all that instrumental in Biden's big decision making on foreign policy. That may be untrue. They may have a closer relationship than I ever was able to appreciate or most of us were able to see. But she may have, therefore, the benefit of a certain space, a certain plausibility that she really is considerably different than Biden. However, I think that in the end, she's going to be advised by, you know, solid centrist foreign policy experts from the Democratic Party, many of whom have been part of the Biden and Obama and Clinton worlds previously. And so she's coming out of a tradition that I don't think she's likely to deviate that far from fundamentally. It's moderate on security issues. It's pro-arms control, but realistic. It's tough on China, but still keep the dialogue going. Supportive of NATO and Ukraine. These big pillars of foreign policy thinking, I would expect that she would adopt most of them.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America. I'm Lori London. As we've reported, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump this week had their first and likely only debate ahead of the November 5th presidential election. But just moments after the candidates walked off stage, pop superstar Taylor Swift endorsed Harris in a social media post to her millions of followers.
She also cited that Donald Trump shared fake AI images of Taylor Swift saying that she endorsed Donald Trump and that she wanted to fight misinformation with the truth. And that was speaking out and saying who she was going to be backing in this election.
Kimberly Cruesi with the Associated Press says it's unknown how much of an impact Swift's endorsement is going to have in this very tight race where every vote counts.
Taylor Swift is from Pennsylvania, which is a battleground state, and it's where the debate was held on Tuesday. However, one thing is known, when Taylor Swift speaks, young people and people across this country listen.
Both the Harris and Trump campaigns are hoping to sway younger voters, a segment of the population that could potentially tip the scales. Around 41 million members of Gen Z, people under the age of 27, will be eligible to vote. But will they participate? Joining us now is Carolyn DeWitt, President and Executive Director of Rock the Vote, a group working to get young voters engaged and educated on the candidates' positions that could potentially impact their future.
Young people have been important to elections, but they haven't always been motivated to turn out. What are you seeing this year as far as younger voter engagement and registering and planning to vote?
Historically, young voters have not turned out at the same rate as older voters, primarily because they're new voters. They're new to the process. So every generation since 18-year-olds got the right to vote, they have turned out at 20 to 30 points lower than older voters in presidential elections. That disparity is even greater in midterms and in local elections. So it's really about not so much a motivation gap, so much as a education gap and empowering them to go through the process of registering before their deadlines. Oftentimes, they don't even know that they have a registration deadline. Walking them through the process of understanding who and what are on their ballot and who most aligns with their values, making sure they understand what early voting options might be available to them, their voter ID requirements, especially as we've seen an increase of voter suppression suppression efforts against young people, trying to prevent them from getting to the polls as they've broken turnout records in 2018, 2020, and 2022. So it's less of a motivation issue. We know that the young voters are passionate about the issues, and it's more about making sure that they understand, one, the power that they have and the process to participate.
How are you going about making sure they get that information?
The beauty of Rock the Vote, for over 30 years, we have been leveraging culture and technology to reach young people where they are. We work with a combination of trusted messengers. So, you know, it might be a high school teacher, it might be a peer of theirs, it might be a brand that they work with where they're employed, or historically, as we have known, all of the celebrities, musicians, and artists that we work with as well. So we reach out through the culture space to meet them where they are, also online through social media, where they are getting a lot of their information. And we use research messaging to help them, again, walk them through the process. And once we get them to rockthevote.org, it's basically a one-stop shop to help them through the process with information specific to their states and their specific situations, and also tools to help them through the process to register to vote, check their registration status, look up their polling place, look up their ballot, and see who's endorsing the candidates and ballot measures on their ballot. So it's really about reaching out, getting them where they are, and then welcoming them into the civic space, the political space, and giving them the tools and information they need.
And you mentioned celebrities. One of the biggest ones out there is Taylor Swift, who just endorsed Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Will that actually make a difference?
Since Rock the Vote's beginning in 1990, you know, we've been encouraging and working with musicians and athletes and other cultural figures to really encourage and build young people's political power, to really amplify the power that they have to shape the future of their communities and their country. So it's really great to see, you know, celebrities like Taylor Swift and others who have been role models for young voters, standing up and encouraging new voters to get to the polls and really saying no one can sit on the sidelines when our future depends on it. So there might be less of an impact that we think about in terms of encouraging one candidate over another, although I'm sure that there is some aspect to that. But it's also, and primarily, I would say, about raising the awareness and the importance of the election and participating in it.
There is at least an assumption that young people, while the future really is all about them, haven't always felt like their vote would make a difference. And so I think there was a bit of apathy. Do you see more of engagement and more enthusiasm now? Has that changed?
The stories we hear from young voters are there's understandable frustration about the world that they are being handed over. There are several issues from climate change, gun violence, immigration, attacks on abortion and the right to an abortion, and the increasing cost of higher education, and these issues that have not been dealt with that are now reaching a critical tipping point. And they are very aware that they're the generation that is going to have to both face the consequences of the inaction on these issues and also have to solve for these issues. So they're looking for candidates who have bold policies and bold approaches to the issues that they care about and that they are experiencing in their everyday lives. I think what we have seen, certainly since the shuffle at the top of the ticket, is that young people are more engaged because they are seeing that there is more attention to the issues that they care about. And we're seeing actually the Harris-Waltz campaign really lean into and embrace Gen Z culture, from addressing the issues head on to the memes to speaking in their language and not being shy and meeting them, frankly, where they are beforehand.
Do you think this could be the year that younger voters' voices actually sway an election?
I think this would not be the first. We've seen actually in 2018 and 2020 and 2022 that elections were decided by young voters. I mean, the reality is we have 41 million members of Gen Z who are eligible to vote. And when you look at, you know, even the 2020 election was came down to around 80,000 votes across six states. There is no path to victory for the presidential candidate without the youth vote. And as you trickle down into Senate, congressional, state elections, those elections oftentimes are even closer. And so young people certainly can decide and have been deciding elections.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thank you.
Carolyn DeWitt, President and Executive Director of Rock the Vote. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.